Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the Liberal Democrat leader Nick Clegg. As Deputy Prime Minister, he's the most powerful Liberal since Lloyd George led a coalition government during the First World War. 90 years ago, the Liberals needed the support of the Conservatives in order to govern. This time around, of course, it's the Lib Dems doing the propping up. There's a life outside Westminster too. He speaks 5 languages, has 3 young children, and worked on both the left and the right of the political spectrum before standing for election himself. He says, joining the Liberal Party was a no-brainer for me. When you're a young man, you don't get a calculator out saying, when am I going to get to power? You're propelled forward by idealism. So propelled by idealism, Nick Clegg, but not apparently sustained by it. Your ideals weren't much in evidence as you patted George Osborne on the back this week after he delivered the most swinging cuts this country has seen in living memory.
Well, of course, I wasn't doing so with any sense of relish or triumphalism about what we had to announce, but we've had to, as a government, announce extraordinary, difficult and unpopular and controversial things. And I've spent, every day of this process, and pretty well every minute of this process, asking myself whether there are sort of pain-free alternatives, whether we're doing the right thing. And I genuinely believe that there is no easy alternative.
People's beef with you, of course, is that the Tories are doing what they say on the tin. There's George Osborne doing what everybody knew he'd do, but there are you doing something that people quite clearly did not think you would support.
Yeah, I don't, of course, accept that, because I don't think there's anything progressive or fair or liberal about saying, well, this is all too controversial, we're going to get other people to pay off our debts. I wish it were otherwise, of course, but I think it's very important for people like me, who feel very much, you know, on the sort of progressive side of British politics, to understand that simply ducking this doesn't actually make Britain better. It makes it in many ways worse. In fact, in many ways, the risk is you'd end up having to take more difficult cuts in a sharper way at a later stage, and I don't think that's right.
You have not then had any dark nights of the soul this week? You've not woken up and thought, what the hell am I doing and why the hell am I helping this through?
Oh, I've certainly, you know, searched long and hard into my own conscience about whether I think what we're doing is for the right reasons, and I genuinely wouldn't stand by it if I didn't think it was. I'm not going to hide the fact that a lot of this is both difficult. I find it morally difficult. It's difficult for the country. I think on these issues about how do you try and do difficult things today in order to create a better tomorrow, you've got to be able to look at yourself in the mirror and say, am I doing this for the right reasons? Am I doing it for the right motives? And am I doing it in the best possible way that I can? And so far, yeah, I've tried to pass that test at each step.
I don't wish to get too personal too early, but you do look very tired and you do look very worn down by it all.
I'm tired, but that's a combination of work and small children. No, I'm not worn down by it. I think this is not a time for sort of triumphalism and bunting. This is a serious time. I'm not going to sit around pretending it's a laugh a minute. It clearly isn't.
This is Desert Island Discs, of course, and there is plenty of time for the music. I don't know if you monitor the Twitter sphere, but it has been incredibly busy this week with speculation about what you've chosen. Among the suggested choices, the first cut is the deepest and Puppet on a String. I notice neither of them are on your list, but no. Did you find your list particularly hard to come up with?
Actually, if I look a little bit tired, it's probably because I left the selection of this list very late in the day. Stayed up till about 2 o'clock in the morning the other day, listened to music, and I loved it. I don't think I've sat with sort of CDs spread all around me on the floor listening to music in an uninterrupted way. So I actually really, really enjoyed picking this list. It was tricky. It was unbelievably tricky to pick.
Tell me about your first choice today then, Nick.
Well, first is a waltz by Chopin. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece of music, but why I just love it. Miriam is a great, great pianist, and you know, I think I'm the luckiest man in the world to be married to Miriam, and I always think of her when I listen to this music, because she played this a lot when she was pregnant with our first boy, Antonio, who's now 8 years old. Thank you.
That was Idil Barrett playing Chopin's Waltz in A minor. And you said, Nick Clegg, that you remember your wife Miriam playing that during her first pregnancy. I'm wondering if you, well, I was going to say sought her permission. I'm quite sure that's the wrong phrase. But certainly if you sought her counsel when you were offered the job of Deputy Prime Minister.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have a very, very strong, but very private marriage. And Miriam has, I think, an extraordinarily smart way of, you know, looking at things. So, yeah, we talked about it a lot. And, of course, it's also asking a great deal of her. She's not only married to me, to a politician, which is bad enough, but, you know, we've got three little boys, you know, like all small children. That takes a lot of time. And she works full-time as a lawyer. So I'm racking up a lot of debt towards Miriam in terms of how much forbearance she's showing towards me.
She is astonishingly straightforward in her dealings with the press, something that I think garners her certainly a lot of respect among women that I've encountered. She said during the election campaign itself, when asked if she would be supporting you throughout, I can't just take 6 weeks off my work, you know.
No, yes.
Like she's... most people. Yes, she seems very unspun.
Yeah, she's very unspun. Of course, I'm not... objective. I think Miriam's one of the most authentic and true people, you know, I've ever met. I'm not even sure if she's aware of that gift. It's a fantastic thing.
Her father spent many years in Spanish politics,
yes,
as a senator, so she is able to understand politics from the inside.
Yeah, no, she does sometimes. We talk a lot about the comparison. Her father, who very sadly died some years ago in a car crash, was an extraordinary man, and he was part of that generation of Spanish politicians who created Spanish democracy.
So what advice then, and what did she say to you when you discussed the possibility of becoming Deputy Prime Minister?
I mean, I think we kind of wrestled with it, really. And, you know, was it the right... I don't think we had any illusions about the risks, both political and the impact on our family. We've been very, very kind of scrupulous at trying to shelter our family and shelter our children. We, you know, stay in the same home, and not perhaps this week very much, but in other weeks I still walk the children to school, and we keep them out of the public eye, and so on. And I think Miriam wanted, you know, a clear sense of assurance, if you like, that we could continue to do that. And we still try and do that.
Three young children. The eldest is 8. The youngest is 18.
He's one year and 10 months. Yeah.
I read Miriam say in an interview recently when she was asked about you, she said, you know, I don't really see my husband these days. I mean, it must put a terrific...
A little, I saw that. I rang her straight after. I said, what do you mean? I'm seeing you in a minute. We have a sort of rule. We try, you know, one of us takes them to school and one of us puts them to bed every night. That's what we try and do. Sometimes we fail, but we're pretty good at it.
How are the percentages falling right now?
Oh, right now, completely on Miriam's shoulders, and I've failed utterly. But, you know, hopefully I can balance it out a bit over time. And... you know, look, in many ways, we're very similar to young parents who both work up and down the country. You're constantly juggling it. You constantly feel slightly guilty, but you try and do your best. And that's what I think, you know, most young parents do these days.
A lot of young parents look at each other, of course, and say, how long is this going to go on? I mean, has Miriam given you a time limit on this? Has she said, OK, you can have 5 years of your big, high-flying political career, and then it's got to stop?
I don't know. She hasn't. I think she's probably sorely tempted every day to impose a sort of sell-by date on it. But so far, she hasn't quite declared that yet. But I wouldn't be surprised if one day she does.
She's a tolerant woman. Tell me about your next piece of music, then.
This is just one of my... absolutely fantastic. Johnny Cash, Sunday Morning Coming Down. It's just fantastic. But why I love this is because when I come from quite a large family, 4 brothers and sisters, and we used to often go on sort of road trips with my parents. They used to sort of drive us across, you know, Europe through the night, and they'd play Johnny Cash a lot. So this reminds me a lot when I was much, much, much younger, driving through the night with my parents and my brothers and sisters.
Well, I woke up Sunday morning with no way to hold my head. That didn't hurt. And the beer I had for breakfast wasn't bad, so I had one more for dessert. Then I fumbled in my closet, threw my clothes and found my cleanest dirty shirt.
That, of course, was Johnny Cash and Sunday Morning Coming Down. Nick Clegg, you say memories there of driving through Europe with your parents on holiday. You were one of 4 children.
Yes.
Born in 1967, brought up in Buckinghamshire. Your father was a banker, your mother was a teacher, and that all sounds very middle class and, you know, pretty predictable, I suppose, until we learned that you all spoke Dutch around the kitchen table. Explain that one.
Yeah, I mean, we're a bit of a sort of mongrel family. My mum's Dutch, my dad's half Russian. And I've now compounded that by being married to a Spaniard. And we were brought up bilingually. Yeah, in fact, Dutch was my first sort of language. So it was a very, yes, it was a very international kind of environment. My mum's family, very close, very big family. We'd spend all our holidays with my Dutch cousins. It's very lively, very, very warm, loud, very loving family.
And you say your mother's family particularly close. Your mother had spent time in a Japanese prisoner of war camp.
Yes, she was born in Indonesia because her dad worked for, you know, what is now Shell in Indonesia. And so she spent the whole war as a young girl in a Japanese prisoner of war camp and, you know, was close to being starved to death by the end of the war and, of course, saw quite horrific things. Actually, I've realised now, age 43, how much she basically didn't tell us.
Yes.
You know, she just sheltered us from a lot of those, you know, harrowing memories. I think it strengthened my mum's resolve to try and create the sort of most happy, protected childhood for myself, my two brothers and my sister. And I think she succeeded. I mean, we had an extraordinarily happy childhood.
Well, I will ask you, and you might not answer, but what were some of the worst things that she went through while she was there?
You know, if you're a young girl and you see people being sort of, you know, beaten to a pulp in front of you and you know, people being sort of dragged off and shot, I can only imagine what that must be like for a child of the age of, well, my oldest boy now. So, but you know, I'm not going to sort of try and pretend that I can do justice to the things she saw.
What about your father? His background pretty exotic too.
Well, his father was a very accomplished medic and was the editor of the British Medical Journal for a long time. His mother was, my grandmother was Russian and was part of that Russian diaspora that was sort of ejected from Russia at the time of the revolution and then moved to the Baltic states and then from the Baltic states to Germany and from Germany to London. I mean, it was a generation that witnessed the revolutions and the wars of the 20th century like no other generation did. And I always think it's just quite remarkable how resilient they were.
And tell me about, was it Aunt Maura?
Aunt Maura was, in a sense, adopted my grandmother as her daughter, but was actually my grandmother's aunt.
Yes.
And she was this extraordinary figure. She had relationships with H.G. Wells and Maxim Gorky and was accused of being a double agent. And it was just this... I have very, very vague memories of her when I was small. I found her utterly terrifying and imposing. And I mean, I remember she would come and visit us and she would sort of look at me sternly and say in a thick Russian accent, which I won't try and imitate, sort of, "Speak up, boy." And I would sort of continue to mumble and then scuttle away. But she was this extraordinary survivor and who rebuilt her life here in London and became a great figure on the sort of bohemian theatre and art scene here in London. She would hold sort of, you know, soirees and evenings,
right.
And people would come and she would drink everybody else under the table.
You say there were suspicions or rumours that she was a double agent. You surely, in your position now, must be able to get to the bottom of that.
No, actually, that's an idea. You mean I think I should ask to look at some...
Yes, I do. I'm surprised you haven't already.
Do you know, I'd prefer to keep it as a complete mystery.
Let's have some more music then, Nick Clegg. What are we going to hear next?
Oh, Prince. I just think Prince is fantastic. It's such quirky, clever music. And I spent a year in Minneapolis as a student and saw him there a couple of times. I just think he's brilliant.
Black day, stormy night, no love, no hope in sight. Don't cry, he is coming. Don't die without knowing the cross.
That was Prince and the Cross, memories there of your days in Minneapolis. We will talk about Minneapolis a little later, but for now I want to find out a little bit more about young Master Clegg. Chalfont St. Peter, then, you were brought up in Buckinghamshire.
Yes, and then we moved a bit later to near Oxford, yeah.
OK, but... I'm wondering, it's quite near Chequers, the Chalfont. Did you ever see a Prime Minister choppering in or coming through the streets? Or no?
I don't have any memory of it. I mean, I know it's sort of conventional for politicians to say, oh, you know, from when I was knee-high to a grasshopper, I dreamed to be able to walk through the door of Downing Street. Actually, politics, certainly compared to many other politicians, came actually relatively late to me.
Worryingly, the worst misdemeanour I can find out about your school time is that you set fire to some cacti.
Indeed, yes.
Is that it?
No, but I think that probably the rest of it can cast a veil over the rest.
I don't think we can.
Yeah, well, I think we can. No. I was in, like any other teenager.
A litre of cider around the back of the bike sheds, that sort of stuff.
At least. Look, I'm not going to be sort of boastful about my teenage misdemeanours, but I had a lot of fun when I was a teenager. I went to school in the centre of London. I mean, it was quite a... liberal school. So if you wanted to, you could have a, you know, you could have a very interesting time.
Yes, you went to school at Westminster, a very reputable and high-end school.
Incredibly lucky, yeah.
They're fast and loose, those boys at Westminster, and indeed some of the girls. I mean, they know how to have fun, and a lot of them are notable for, by the ages of, you know, 13, 14, 15, being rather accelerated in their development because they're living in the centre of London, because they have access to
it. It was a big thing, actually. It was a big change for me because I grew up, if not a million miles away from London, at least, you know, outside London, in the kind of slightly more rural area, if you like. I remember going to Westminster School. I never spent, you know, any time or even a night in London before then. So it was like the scales fell from my eyes. It was an extraordinary experience, sort of being in this. It was a very precocious, very intense atmosphere, and I found it all very all very new.
And those girls in the sixth form then, when you took them on dates, where would you take them?
Probably just to the local cafe for a sort of furtive silk cut and a glass of Diet Coke. I can't remember.
Really, is the most you inhaled just a silk cut then?
I've always said I think that there are parts of my life that probably are best kept under sort of lock and key. If you go into politics, you have to accept that you become subject to constant public criticism, commentary and so on. And I guess what you need to ask yourself is, you know, at what point can you kind of legitimately draw a line and say, look, what I did when I was 11 or 12 or 13 or 14, or whether I threw sand in someone's eyes when I was, you know, a toddler. I mean, there's got to be you've got to be able to legitimately say, look, there's totally reasonable scrutiny about what you do when you're an adult, and then there's kind of what you are as a youngster.
I understand that. I'm not so interested in the sand bit, but I am very interested in the fact that a very modern politician like Barack Obama is happy to write about his experiences with drugs and say, yes, absolutely, part of my experience. And do you know what it does? It helps me understand your experience as a teenager, as a parent. I wonder why in Britain we are still absolutely hidebound by those sort of rather 1950s notions of what's proper.
I think to be fair, it's changing. I think as politicians, we are all quite rightly expected to be open and almost sort of confessional in a way that a generation ago would have been unimaginable. Do I think that everybody who goes into politics has got to first accept that they allow, you know, their whole life to be subject to line-by-line scrutiny, intrusion and criticism?
Just the silk cut, then. Tell me about the next track.
The next one is Cesaria Evora. She's an amazing singer, and this reminds me a lot of the time when Miriam and I, before we got married, we lived in Brussels. And it's actually where our first two boys were born. So it just brings incredibly happy memories back of, you know, when we were first married and had our first home and our children were first born. It's a beautiful song.
Nasceu, põe uma estrela que cata brilhar. Lina mar, põe uma areia que cata molhar. Espanhol desse mundo fora, só rote mar, terra pouco cheia de amor. Tem morna, tem coladeira, terra sal cheia de amor. Tem batu, tem funaná.
Cesaria Evora and Petit Pay. Nick Clegg, we know then that you studied at Westminster and you went on to Cambridge and then you took a master's degree in Minnesota.
Mm.
Was that where your political ideas began to take shape, do you think?
Actually, it did have a big effect on me, and actually it's where I really first decided kind of ideologically and philosophically that I was a liberal. And of course, one of the great difficulties with politics is that the sheer velocity of politics and the sheer velocity of decisions and responses you have to give in a sort of 24-hour media environment often means you're kind of running before you've really kind of thought through in your own conscience. And that's, you know, and I try and strike that balance. But it just allows your, you know, your mind to settle a bit and really ask yourself sort of big questions about what you're doing and so on. And I don't want to be too sort of pompous about this, but I think I've always had to be able to do that in order to rationalise and justify to myself the things that I believe and the things that I do.
Among other things, you worked as a fact-checker for the left-winger Christopher Hitchens.
Absolutely.
You went to work with Leon Britton at the European Commission in Brussels. From an early point in your career, you were tipped for success. I mean, most young graduates just don't walk into these sort of jobs. Were you? I know you were given at one point a sort of helping hand by Lord Carrington. Do you think that had anything to do with you being elevated, or you think it was just your sort of shining intellect and ability?
No, of course not. Of course I was lucky, incredibly lucky, incredibly privileged to have gone to a great school and have a great education. I mean, you know, I had luck and benefits which I'm acutely aware of, which is out of the reach of many other people. So, no, I'm not going to pretend it's sort of just sort of without help.
And so a degree from Cambridge followed by two master's degrees. You clearly Or I wonder, do you believe that learning is valuable for the sake of learning, for the sake of knowledge?
Oh, of course. Of course it is. It's not, I mean, of course there's a great utility in learning, but it has to be treasured and cherished and valued as an end in itself as well.
There'll be a lot of people taking a sharp intake of breath right now hearing you say that, given that, you know, students of the future might well be put off by the amount of debt they're going to be saddled with, given this government's plans.
Of course, I understand that's the allegation. I mean, I've, you know, wrestled with this one more than anything else, because I had to make I made a pledge which I now find I can't keep, and it's not, you don't do that lightly. I genuinely believe that what we'll come up with in probably in a couple of weeks' time is a lot more progressive and fairer than what we have at the moment.
Have you ever been in debt?
I have a bit, but not in the way. And my whole generation, of course, was able to go to university and not face that, you know, the kind of prospect of paying things off.
Time for some more music then, Nick Clegg. What are we going to hear?
Radiohead. What a great, great band. I've got no great sort of story attached to this, other than the fact that I think a lot of people in my... I'm 43. A lot of people of my generation will have a Radiohead song on their list. And this is one of many great songs.
Rows of houses are bearing down on me. Touching me, oh, this thing's a two-position. Oh, this thing's a one-day swallow hole.
That was Radiohead and Street Spirit. So, Nick Clegg, your career trajectory is nothing short of remarkable. Elected an MP in 2005, 2 years later, you're the party leader, then it's on to deputy prime minister. Meteoric rise doesn't even begin to cover it. Are you a man of ruthless ambition?
I don't think it, I mean, I think it's as much by accident as by design. I entered into Parliament at a time when, you know, the Liberal Democrats were in, there was quite a lot of internal turmoil. I wasn't sort of straining at the bits at all. I mean, there were just events around which kind of, you know, led to the outcome that they did.
And what about the leadership debates then? April the 15th it was, as the lights went down in that ITV studio after the first debate, did you know that you'd pulled the rabbit out of the hat?
Not at all. I hadn't got the slightest idea. I really, really didn't. I remember ringing my mum, because I got in the car, literally just got straight into a car and then went back to the hotel, and I was alone in the car and just sort of rang my mum and said, yeah, you've done really well. Well done. It really didn't... You've got to remember from my point of view, you know, I was constantly reading the papers that Gordon Brown and David Cameron had all these consultants over from America. You know, we were doing this on a shoestring. I mean, had David Laws was pretending to be David Cameron and Chris Hume was pretending to be Gordon Brown, we were sort of practice in sort of small rooms in Westminster. So it was all, in a sense, a lot more by hook or by crook than people, I think, imagined.
And so the next morning when you saw the headlines, you must have been absolutely chuffed.
Yeah, of course I was. I mean, I think there was a very exhilarating feeling after that first debate that you just felt that a lot of people in the country who felt they didn't have more of a choice than just two parties suddenly realised they had more of a choice.
When it came to the negotiations over the coalition government, then obviously an incredibly busy, a whirlwind for you for quite a few days, but you didn't really know David Cameron very well at all.
Didn't really know each other at all.
At what point did you think... Right, now I understand you. I've spent enough time with you. I get it.
I think relatively quickly I sort of felt that, that there was something sincere going on. There was a genuine view that we both shared that no one had won the election. We were all losers. Mm. You know, I sometimes think people have forgotten that. No one won the election. And I think we both saw that quite clearly quite early on, and both saw that what we had to do at this stage was try and provide a sense of stable, strong government for the country. But I mean, look, we didn't know each other. I even texted a friend of mine who I knew him a bit, and I said to him, I just sent a single line text, can I trust this guy? I mean, because that's very important. You need to know that you can deal with each other with a sense of trust.
I'm presuming the answer was yes.
Yep, that's what he said. And you know, I think much as we, you know, might battle out our disagreements behind closed doors, I think we've continued to work in a spirit of kind of mutual respect.
Can you give me a sort of snapshot of what those negotiations were like? Was there a moment when you sat alone with David Cameron and eyeballed each other?
There was a moment when the negotiations were not going in the wrong direction. We couldn't agree on a range of issues that we said, look, this is not going to work, so let's just do what they call in the Westminster jargon confidence and supply. That's basically you have a minority government. And then we would sort of say, well, we'll support them on this and not on that. And there was a moment, it was a telephone call, that's the least way I remember it, where I think just both of us said pretty well at the same time, that's just not good enough. It's just, it won't last. It'll be unstable. The country won't like it. We won't be able to do the difficult things. We've got to go further. That was a very crucial moment that I thought, no, we've got to take a bigger, even bigger risk. Because it's a hugely risky thing to do, of course, politically. Particularly, bluntly, for the party that is smaller.
Yeah. And given that it's such a risk, what did you feel as you put the phone down from that conversation?
I just felt it was a bit like what we were saying earlier. I just felt I had thought it all through and there were no other easy options.
Do you worry about selling out your party? Do you ever think, you know, I made the decision, but with hindsight, might have been smarter to make a different one?
No, I don't think of that at any moment at all. I think actually if you look at the... I understand everything is obscured at the moment by the perfectly understandable controversy about where the savings are being made. What I hope is that over time people will see that the picture that is emerging from what this government is doing is a good, progressive one.
Let's have some more music then, Nick. What are we going to hear now?
David Bowie. What a genius. You can almost feel, you know, not least in this great song, Life on Mars, that he's not just playing it, he's also kind of... In every instrument, he's across every instrument.
It's a freaky show. Take a look at the old man, beating up the wrong guy. Oh man, wonder if you'll ever know who's in the best-selling show. Is there life on Mars?
That was David Bowie and Life on Mars. I wonder, Nick Clegg, in this period, this incredible period of activity in your life, you've also managed to father three children.
Yeah.
You know, it takes a lot of time to be a father to three children.
Yeah,
and
yes.
there was a moment, I think it was the moment when you were first elected an MP. It was the birth of your second child, which was particularly dramatic.
Oh, we had a horrible year. It was a horrible year when Antonio, our oldest, he had pneumonia and then it went into pleurisy and then it was misdiagnosed. Anyway, it's all too horrific to go into, and he had to have sort of emergency surgery and ended up in intensive care, and it was just horrible. I mean, watching a two-year-old
horrendous,
helplessly being sort of pumped full of antibiotics one day after the next, it doesn't make any difference, is bad enough. And then a few months later, yes, Miriam gave birth to Alberto, and that went horribly wrong, and Miriam ended up in intensive care, and they were worried that, she was in a very perilous, position. Yeah, and then a few months later, I then went and stood for election. So we had one of those. It was a nightmare. It was just one of those years of enormous convulsions.
A political life demands so much of the individuals who commit to it. At that time, when you were going through such a period of intense family drama from one child to the next, your wife being in intensive care after the birth of your second child, did you ever think, it's not the right time for me?
Yes, I did. Yes, yeah. A lot, I'm sure. Same as everybody. I sometimes think, gosh, you know, wouldn't it be better to do this when the children were grown up? Because you always want to spend more time with the children. Again, I think a lot of people think the same in their own working lives, if they got the balance right.
Yeah, but those moments of drama are different. I think if you have a wife and children who are ill and in hospital, and that's different from just the daily
grind. What I did then is what I would do now, is I just took a whole lot of time off. I just spent, I remember, sleeping night after night in the hospital with Antonio and, taking the time off to make sure that they were healthy and strong. And I would hope I would do exactly the same now. I really am a father before I am a politician. I'm completely besotted with my little boys. They mean everything to me, so...
And you were completely besotted with Miriam when you met her. It was love at first sight, I understand.
It was a real thunderbolt, yes. I mean,
she is a cracking-looking woman.
Oh,
is that what did it?
Well, she's very, very beautiful. I just think, as I said before, I just think Miriam is just so authentic and so true and it's just so direct. And I've never met anyone before, never met anyone since who's anything like her. But we certainly had a linguistic tussle in the sense that I, of course, spoke no Spanish and her English, she'll hate me saying this, but it was almost entirely incomprehensible. So we first few weeks was in sort of halting French. I didn't really understand a word she said for the first few weeks, but I just...
It didn't matter.
I just thought it was brilliant.
Let's have some music.
I should apologise for this to everybody listening. This is actually a track I really find quite annoying, but I would love to have it at my desert island because it reminds me so much, particularly of my youngest little one-and-a-half-year-old. It's Waka Waka. Shakira's the theme tune to the World Cup. And he has worked out with his little fingers how to press the icons on Miriam's iPad.
This is your youngest?
My youngest. He's 1 year and 10 months, and he is obsessed. He'll wake up in the morning and look at you with this... absolutely excited expression and say, "Waka waka." And that's so I listen to this dozens of times every day.
Lucky you.
You know it's serious, we're getting closer, this isn't over.
The pressure's off, you feel it, but you got it all, believe it. When you fall, get up, oh, oh, and if you fall, get up, eh, eh. Tamina, mina, sangalewa, cause this is Africa. Tamina, mina, eh, eh. Waka, waka, eh, eh. Tamina, mina, sangalewa, this time for Africa.
That was Shakira and Waka Waka, the theme to the 2010 World Cup. So I wonder, Nick Clegg, if in the past few months amidst the roller coaster, you ever sort of wake up in the morning and pinch yourself and think, God, this actually really is happening.
I haven't really had the time to do that. But at the moment I thought, wow, this is not quite what I expected. It is actually quite relatively recently I went to the United Nations. And standing at this kind of platform in the United Nations was an extraordinary feeling. I certainly couldn't have predicted a few months ago that would have happened.
Tony Blair said he drank a lot more as a result of being in high office. Do you find yourself reaching for the whiskey bottle or a nice Barolo at the end of the day?
No, I actually drink very little indeed. Next to nothing.
What do you do to relax then?
Well, it's my children. I mean, I'm like any young parent. The wonderful thing with little children is that they don't care who, you know, what I do, what my job is. All they want to know is that I can put Waka Waka onto the iPad, that I can help my middle son with his latest game, Mario Bros, on his DS, and my oldest boy that I can go and take him to his football game on Sundays. And so that has a wonderful kind of, sort of, if you like, liberating effect, because they're totally intolerant of these political preoccupations, and so I just relish every second of being a father.
And what about your parents? Interesting that your mother was sort of pretty low-key about her endorsement of your performance during the leadership debates. What does she make of your performance now on the front bench?
I think she's proud, but I think she's like any mum. She's anxious, you know. Which mum would like to see their son or daughter, you know, being accused of this, that, and the other? So, you know, I think like any parents, they'll worry. But I think, you know, they're very, very supportive. I'm very, very lucky. I've got a big family and a close circle of friends. I've got nothing to do with politics, who are very supportive.
A life on a desert island, then, Nick Clegg. You'll be there. You'll be all alone. You spent a lot of time sort of out playing for hours on end in the woods of Buckinghamshire when you were a child. Are you very practical? Could you lash up a shelter, barbecue some fish, do all that sort of stuff?
I think I could probably try.
Well, Miriam be laughing right now.
Yes, she would. Yes, exactly. That's why I'm saying it somewhat sheepishly. She will find it a completely preposterous suggestion that I would even know how to make my own food.
Just checking. Tell me about your final piece of music then.
This is an impromptu from Schubert. I don't think particularly musical. Miriam is, thankfully. My children are. My brother, my dad are. And my father used to play this a lot when I was younger. It's just the most extraordinary piece of music. I just find it as moving now as I did when I first heard it.
Schubert's Impromptu No. 3 in G-flat, played by Alfred Brendel. So we come to the point then, Nick Clegg, where I'm going to give you the books.
Crunch time.
Yes, crunch time. You get the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare, and you can take one of your own books. What will it be?
The Leopard by Giuseppe di Lampedusa. I'm not sure that's the right pronunciation. It's just the most amazing book of sort of decay and change. I think it's set in Sicily. And I read it again the other day. And it's one of the few books when I read it a second time that I liked it even more than the first time. So I'm assuming my desert island, if I read it a third and a fourth and a fifth time, it'll get better and better.
It's yours. And a luxury.
Well, I have a confession to make, which is that I do like the occasional cigarette, so I wouldn't mind just having a stash of cigarettes. I can just imagine as the sun's going down and I've got the beard, you know, flowing down to my knees, and I'm thinking about what on earth am I going to do to while away the time. Just puffing away at a cigarette would be quite nice. I know I'm not supposed to say this, because it's all, but it's a terrible thing, and I hope my children don't hear this programme because they don't even know that I smoke, but I do like the occasional cigarette.
I'll even give you some matches to go with the cigarettes. And if you had to choose just one of these discs, which one disc would you choose to save?
I think actually it would be the last one, the Schubert Impromptu, and I just think it's very, very beautiful.
Nick Clegg, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.